Hello, welcome once again to Searching for American Gods, an American Gods podcast, basically discussing each weekly episode of the American Gods TV show on Starz Network. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you, sir?
I am fine, Phil. How have you been the last 2 years?
Good, good, yes, because the last episode that we did was basically 2 years ago, because the show has been on hiatus, probably for two reasons. One, a lot of these shows are on hiatus for 2 years, like HBO's Westworld and Game of Thrones and whatnot, because they have a fan base and they know that they can get away with it and, you know, make sure what they want to do. And then the other is because I know you've done some research on American Gods. There's been a lot of changes, at least behind the scenes, not in front of the camera necessarily.
Although there have been a couple of significant changes in front of the camera too.
Right, right. And we'll discuss those in a moment. For folks who are new to this podcast, you can go to wherever podcasts are found, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and you can find the Searching for American Gods podcast. It is under two feeds. It's under the Searching for American God feed, so you can just search for that. Or you could search for Dark Discussions podcast feed, which is the umbrella for this podcast. And that RSS feed includes all the American Gods podcasts, as well as the initial podcast, which is the Dark Discussions podcast, which is a weekly podcast that discusses films in the genre. Basically, myself, I like to include a little more than just straight horror and sci-fi and fantasy. Mike, you, I'm not sure about you, but I know Eric, one of our co-hosts, tries to not allow us to do comic book films, though we've done at least two, and three if we include Ghost in the Shell, which is an anime manga.
That's right. That's cool.
And that's pretty much what we are. DarkDiscussions.com is the website for this podcast, as well as Searching for American Gods and Dark Discussions podcast and any other spinoffs that we do have. Any further house cleaning stuff that you wanted to bring up before we discuss this podcast, it's specifically in what's happened in the hiatus from season one to season two, as well as the first episode of season two, because that's the main reason we're back.
The House on the Rock, right, is the name of the episode. Yeah, so we did cover every episode of the first season. If you want to go back, all that's available on darkdiscussions.com. If you are a new listener who's just picking us up with the new season, welcome aboard. We are one of the sister spinoff podcasts of Dark Discussions. And like you said, it kind of covers everything genre-related with a very broad genre umbrella. Yeah, and there is a lot of dark stuff in here, so it does fit nicely in the Dark Discussions oeuvre. You know, it's just, yeah, it's, I just was rewatching the first season over this past weekend. You know, there were only 8 episodes, so I was able to get it done in about 2.5 days with binge watching. And I kind of forgot how good it was when it was really clicking, even when I think it was making some narrative errors in terms of wasting time or being a little bit too obtuse, I guess. It's like trying to be a little bit too coy with the audience and not letting us know what was going on. I just thought it was visually dynamite, and the performances were always great. And a lot of the dialogue, you know, just, you know, kind of crackled on the screen, especially with Ian McShay, you know, was fantastic, or Orlando Jones as Mr. Nancy. But if you have not, for some reason, watched the first season of American Gods, you should really go watch that. Go listen to the other episodes. And if you can still stomach it, come back and listen to this one. If you've watched the first season and are looking at watching the second, we'll be here presumably for the next 9 weeks after this one.
Yes, and it is an interesting show in the sense that even though it is most certainly a niche audience based off the fact that it is what one of our co-hosts in Dark Discussions, Christy, always says, magical realism show. So it's has some horror and sci-fi and fantasy and mythology and things like that in it, but it's very much a magical realist show, or urban or dark fantasy, if you prefer. So you would figure it would be an interesting show to bring to the screen. Obviously, the book has a big fan base, and Neil Gaiman is a huge author, and I think that's what stars and the showrunners were hoping for in its creation. But folks who aren't familiar with the book or even Neil Gaiman may be questioning what the show is all about. However, like you mentioned, Mike, the performances are fantastic, and they did spend good money for some really well-known character actors, or even in some cases, leading actors or actresses in the past. I mean, Emily Browning, Crispin Glover, Ian McShane, and Peter Stormare. Alone, never mind Gillian Anderson, are like five actors or actresses that are at least huge for genre cinema. Now, you're going to say something, Mike?
Yeah, I was thinking you had Pablo Schreiber was a character actor who's been around for a while.
Kristen Chenoweth, right?
Kristen Chenoweth is certainly an actor of note on Broadway stage.
Cloris Leachman had a role.
Cloris Leachman was there, and Orlando Jones. So yeah, it was a hell of a cast, and that's like one of the comforts I have is that whatever is the turmoil kind of going on behind the scenes, they often say that 90% of the success in making a movie, and I'm imagining a TV show, is casting. You know, if you cast the right people, you can kind of fix everything else up after that. If you don't have the right cast, there's only so much you can do. Right, you either have the charisma, you either have the talent to make it work, or you do not.
To add to that, Mike, that point that you just made, for example, Dark Discussions last year, one of our episodes for that podcast was specifically called, I believe it was called Fractured, and that film was a very small budgeted English film from England, and we discussed that and critiqued it and whatnot. And one of the things I said about that film, whether any of us liked it or not, was that it made me decide after watching it that what you need is actors that can really act. And
right.
that film most certainly had really good actors, and the performances were fantastic. And we've seen many independent or small cinema where it's just, you know, people that rounded up kids from college or their backyard or wherever, and the acting's just horrendous, and the film is bad because of it. So you're absolutely right. I think 90% determines if it's good or not based off of who's in front of the camera. And not necessarily the names, but at least their ability.
No, because there are names out there who are not very good actors. And I'll even take names out there that are not very good actors, but still
have a charisma or something.
Have the charisma, have the presence. And I'll right now, because he's big, is go to Jason Momoa, who played Aquaman. Jason Momoa is not a great actor, or certainly wasn't a great actor in Aquaman, but he has charisma, right? And he carries that charisma outside the screen, which is why he's becoming a big star, right? As people see him in real life. And he's just as much a larger-than-life personality as he appears on the screen. He apparently is very generous and gregarious with fans, and that's great. But it also, you see it on the screen, and people like looking at him more for stuff beyond the fact that he is apparently, according to the ladies in my life, a rather handsome individual. And there are a lot of actors that are like that. They just have that that it factor, right? That, I don't know, whatever it is, they just got it.
Yeah, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, for example.
Right. Yep. Right, and I could see, even when I saw him in terrible, terrible movies, I could see why people are attracted to him, or interested in in Dwayne The Rock Johnson because he's got charisma, right? He can sell a line, even if it's a bad line sometimes, just through pure charisma, less if not so than through acting talent.
Sure, sure. Yeah, exactly. So there's a, and again, both of those things, whether it's acting talent or whether it's charisma or a combination of both, that's, like you said, 90% in front of the camera.
And it doesn't have to be like beautiful person. Like I'll take a look, say like Peter Lorre, right? The old.
Yeah. One of my favorites and you know, she's an attractive woman and whatnot, but Angela Lansbury would not be considered a pinup like some of her contemporaries, but she was a fantastic actress and still is to this day. I think I know what you mean. And Peter Lorre was fantastic as well, right?
Yeah. Peter Lorre, fantastic character actor. In fact, we look at a lot of the best, the actor nominations for, the Oscars this year, a lot of them were character actors. They weren't stars. And sometimes it's the star, the day of the star has kind of moved on a little bit, and it's mostly now, can you do the job? Can you effectively portray what they want you to portray? I certainly think that they have a great set of actors here, led by Ian McShane, and pretty much top to bottom. There's not a single false note, I think, in the cast, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Not yet. And some of this was has changed. Like I know, so I having just rewatched, I listened to the commentary track for that they had on the disc set for the first season of American Gods, and they have two commentary tracks for the first episode, and there was some recasting there. Pablo Schreiber is the guy who plays Matt Sweeney, the giant lucky leprechaun, was a like a last minute replacement for someone else. I'm trying to remember the guy's name, and I know the actor's face really, really well, and I can never remember his name.
And would you know any items that he's been in?
The thing that most people would know him best for, he was the villain in the last two Mission Impossible films.
Oh, the guy that played Superman?
No, he was only in the last Mission Impossible film.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Sean Harris.
Sean Harris, thank you very much. I can never remember his name.
Yeah,
right.
Good.
So he was supposed to be the original Sean Matt Sweeney, and I'm sure he would have been great in a very different way. You know, but Pablo Schreiber has just done so well with it. It's, you know, it's that classic example of you can't imagine anybody else being in that role. So
yeah, interesting. I did not know Sean Harris. That would have been good. I like Sean Harris. But yeah, Pablo Schreiber is quite fine. Absolutely. And to be honest, I believe both Sean Harris and Pablo Schreiber are neither Irish, and yet either, both of them are playing an Irish, or would have been playing an Irish character. That's kind of funny. All right. So, and so one of the strong aspects about this show is the acting. So if people are going to be turned off with the show, it definitely wouldn't be the acting. It would be, depending on whether or not they like mystical type stuff like this, you know, magical realism, urban fantasy stuff. And unlike, say, True Blood, which you could argue is a magical realism, urban fantasy, dark fantasy, this one is definitely not as strongly in the real world. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that, you know, in other words, True Blood had a place and you knew there was these supernatural beings that just happened to be in the world. Here, it's so much different. It's hard to explain without really showing the film to someone first or the show. But basically, it's about the old gods and new gods. Old gods meaning Norse, Greek, Roman, various other smaller cultures and their gods. How at one time they are created by people, and as long as people know they exist or worship them, they have power. And basically they're created out of thin air, almost similar to like the Candyman in that movie. And now the newer gods are things like social media, technology, things of that nature. And as people use that and their lives revolve around that, gods are created from there. And they then are now, I guess, in a competing mode between the old gods and the new gods.
Right. They refer to Gillian Anderson's character, Media, refers to the fact that there's an altar in every living room in America, meaning the television, right? There's this TV screen there.
Sure.
That we all worship, and by which they don't mean make sacrifices to, and they don't mean pray to, but that we stare at and we pay attention to.
You know, it's funny, as the book was probably written, you know, was written, what, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years ago, and now if Neil Gaiman wrote it, he probably would say the cell phone and the TV.
Right, and that's a plot point where the goddess of fertility, you know, is one of the oldest goddesses, the character Bilquis. At one point, after she's booted out of Iran, is wandering the streets of Los Angeles homeless, and she's given a cell phone by the technical boy as they recruit her to their side. You know, and she updates herself by becoming sort of the goddess of Tinder, for lack of a better term, or the goddess of dating apps, or, you know, I imagine internet porn, whatever it is people are watching on their phone that has to do with sex and fertility. That's where she's drawing her power from now. So she's found a way to find a new way there. So, yeah, there's all sorts of stuff that they've managed to update with the new technology.
Right, exactly. Watching episode one of season two, it's really makes a lot more sense now than it did in season one, because I went in completely blind, knowing nothing about the book, and it was a bit confusing, never mind not necessarily being a fan of magical realism. But as the season went, you know, you begin to understand what's going on and figuring it out. So when I rewatched, or I should say watched for the first time, this season two, episode one, and they discuss a little bit about what we just mentioned about, you know, the power comes from something, whether it's people, whether it's, like you said, Tinder apps and pornography online. It makes a lot more sense now, and that the gods, at least in Neil Gaiman's universe for this book and this TV show, are basically not figments of humans' imagination, but created by the zeitgeist of people as they worship, and worship, as you said, Mike, with quotes around it, certain things, whether it's at church, old gods that are just remembered because of hand-me-downs, or like you mentioned, the fertility goddess. Originally, she linked to Jesus by taking her day, which was Easter, and having it linked to Jesus, who is Easter as well, and then eventually became more powerful in the new world by, like you said, the Tinder apps and stuff. I assume that's what you're meaning, right?
Right, and the Vulcan was the god of the forge, who becomes the god of the gun. You know, they all find a way to find a new niche. The quote-unquote new gods, the gods who have thrived, are ones who found new niches in the modern world. So, yeah, so that kind of sets up the series, and it's a battle between the new and the old. Now, should we take a moment, speaking of battles, to talk about what has happened in the last 2 years?
Yeah, I think that is fairly important, though I didn't really feel much change between season one and season two, at least the feel of the show, and hopefully that will be the case. But there's been a lot of upheaval and changes with the show for a number of reasons, directly related to the show, directly related to the TV station that's playing it, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, go ahead, Mike. You can start.
Yeah, so American Gods is based on the Neil Gaiman novel, and it was originally produced and created and produced as a series or co-produced with Brian Fuller and Michael Green. Brian Fuller and Michael Green are, I guess, long-term partners. Brian Fuller is the better-known one. Brian Fuller was the show creator for TV series like Dead Like Me, Wonder Falls. He had a hand in creating Heroes and Pushing Daisies and Hannibal, Star Trek Discovery, and American Gods. The problem
did he do 6 Feet Under, too, or is that someone else?
That was somebody else.
Okay.
He has a very distinctive style, and he has a very strong visual sense. And if you've watched Hannibal, which is the only series he's gone, that and Pushing Daisies, I think, were the only two he went through entirely. Wonder Falls was canceled after one season. He left Dead Like Me, I think, after the first season. And it's the kind of thing where if you know his stuff, and I wasn't aware of this at the time, but you could tell that there's something slightly different in season two that wasn't there in season one. And this feels a little bit different, but I don't know if it's because of his absence or because of a change in the story, right? And, the story has necessitated certain changes to the characters and the dialogue and stuff like that. But it shouldn't be a big shock he left, both for that reason, because he has a history of doing this. He apparently, no one says he's difficult to work with, but when you can kind of leave that many jobs, you get the sense that he might be difficult to work with.
Or at least he gets bored quickly, one of the
other.
Well,
yeah, so it cost, the first season went $30 million over budget.
That's a lot for a niche show, for sure.
Well, for an 8-episode series.
No, that's even a good
$30 million an episode. Yep. For a season, rather. That's almost $4 million per episode. That's a lot. That's an awful lot to be. So anyway, they apparently wanted the two producers, according to the rumors. There were fights with the studio over the budget, but there was also fights with Neil Gaiman, who is a co-producer. And
so Fuller and Green were fighting with Gaiman and Starz.
Right, because they wanted to pull the story a bit further away
from the book,
from the novel. Right.
Right.
And I'm trying to find. I've missed it. I had it somewhere, and now I've lost it. So there was that. Now with that, Brian Fuller brought Gillian Anderson, and he brought Kristen Chenoweth. He's worked with Gillian Anderson on Hannibal and Kristen Chenoweth on Pushing Daisies, were the main ones that I can think of that they worked together on.
Sure. So this is very similar to Frank Darabont when he started The Walking Dead. Like 90% of the cast were people that used to work with him in his movies, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Okay.
So there was that. And then, in the interim, they fired the new showrunner, which was Jesse Alexander. And that one, I read something that was kind of... Well, in both cases, they said they weren't fired, but they didn't quit either. But they knew we weren't working on the show either, so I don't know exactly what that means.
Right. So it probably was a contract was signed that he was about to work on the show, and then as the development stage happened, he probably butted heads with Neil Gaiman again and maybe some of the Starz producers.
Right.
That's a guess. That's all. Now, who is this guy that Alexander guy, you said?
Right. So Jesse Alexander is a guy that had worked with these guys before. And he didn't last very long. And so apparently they dumped all their, they had written, it's a short season, right? It's 10 episodes or less.
Yep.
They had 6 screenplays completed. They dumped all 6 and had to go back to rewriting those 6 episodes. Reportedly, Gaiman had a hand in that and wanted to bring everything closer to where his novel was.
Sure, and that makes sense.
Right.
Because we saw a couple of things in season one that were not directly related to the novel that were added that you could tell felt forced into, to make it more modern.
Right.
you know, and I felt it didn't work myself. But
so this was last September, right? I found this article. This is off of IGN, and it was actually, this is a quote from THR, whatever, the Hollywood Reporter.
Mm-hmm.
So Alexander last September was fired but not fired and is no longer working on the drama as a writer or showrunner, and has been asked not to sit in on editing, to be involved on set, or to participate in any other areas of production or post-production. So, kind of a go away. There are rumors that the cast was very unhappy, that they were rewriting their own dialogue on set. More and more of the power, I guess, has gone into Gaiman's hands. I don't know, you know, how much of the problems... So I don't know how much of the problem is because Gaiman wasn't getting his way, and or how much of it's because the new showrunner was not doing a good job and the scripts were bad, and Gaiman was not there very much in the first season. He had a much more hands-off approach and was trying to get more involved. So I don't know the real power struggle here. Now, Gaiman's got a great reputation as a writer and deserved reputation as a writer. You know, so I don't know that how much of a hand he had in the scripts. Was he someone who came in to try to fix the scripts? And this is all happening very late into production. There was just a lot of unhappiness, unfortunately. You know, most of these guys are under contract. Chris, I don't know what it was. I imagine maybe Gillian Anderson had some sort of clause in hers saying that she could leave if he left, because he was the reason she went there. Christian Chenoweth was only hired, you know, for one episode last season, and unfortunately it was a pivotal part, and her not coming back has created a small problem for this season.
Right.
You
know.
But
you never know. I mean, they could always recast. You know, I mean, Game of Thrones, you know, did that once with the guy that used to, you know, the number one person for Daenerys.
Right. Dario.
Yeah, Dario. Yeah.
Dario. And so they recast the mountain twice.
Yes, they did. That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of cases where you can cast and recast. And the problem is they seem to have just completely forgotten the main plot twist at the end of the last episode of the first season, which was the destruction of the crops.
Right.
There was one mention on the radio about, you know, this blight in Kentucky, you know, and that's it. That's the only mention of what was the big cliffhanger of season one.
Right.
So her, you know, whether they will pick it up later, because I guess she's done her job by creating the blight, by removing spring.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, you know, if they want, they.
I guess it was a regional thing instead of international.
Yeah, and they could, or maybe it'll be a bigger issue later on as the show progresses, and maybe they just want to focus this first episode on the meeting at the Rock. So I don't want to be too. Jump to conclusions here, right? I don't want to be too presumptive that they have completely dumped this storyline. We will see what happens with it later on down the road.
Right, right. Yeah, there's still seven more episodes. So
right.
we'll figure that out. Yep.
So it's unfortunate that there's this much turmoil. I thought the show worked really well, but it does seem like not Neil Gaiman, that Fuller just was somebody who likes to spare no expense, and he makes a joke about it in his commentary track on the very first episode. If you remember, the first episode begins with the Vikings coming to America.
Yes.
And he jokes that, you know, when they said, you're going to do this, the whole thing with the boat, that's going to be CGI. And he's like, nope, we're going to actually build the boat. You know, if there's an expensive way to do it, we're going to do it the expensive way.
Right. Well, and that's the reason why the North American Aborigine, Eskimo, Native American, I'm not sure what it was because I can't remember. There was a whole scene that was computer generated in like episode 5 or 6 of last year.
Right.
And that was supposed to be live action, and maybe Fuller lost that battle. Because of the budget, you know what I'm saying?
Right, because that also had like a woolly mammoth in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so maybe he did. Now it worked because they did the whole thing CG.
Yep.
It's just, I don't know. The main thing is, I think what's on screen works. It has a different feel to it to me. it feels more direct, right? It's not as, it's not being quite as coy as it was in the first season, but part of it's because the hands are on the cards are on the table now, right?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was, there's some moments in this episode here, House on the Rock, where they were most certainly, like 5 to 10 minutes of the episode was really just to show off the computer graphics, you know, for us to be in awe with, you know, Odin's castle and the carousel and all those things. So certain aspects of this were more of a showpiece rather than storytelling. But for the 50 minutes or so of this episode, you're absolutely right. It was more direct. It wasn't trying to figure out what was going on. Again, like I said, for me, my experience was the first season, I was confused. Like, what is this supposed to be? Who are these gods? How can they exist? Did it, you know, who's Shadow and all these other things? And again, I went in completely blind, not knowing anything about the story in the book. But now for season two, episode one, even though I was questioning whatever happened to the cliffhanger, like you just mentioned from last season. But besides that confusion, I understood what was going on, and it made much more sense because, like you said, everything's on the table. We now know and understand who these gods are and how they exist, and we know the point of the whole thing, which is the old versus the new now.
Right. So, anyway, so let's get into... So, with all that said, should we get into the...
Well, who's the showrunner now?
I don't... I'm trying to find the name, and I can't find it.
Yeah, same here. I'm not quite sure who it is either, and what they have to do with you know, the whole story, in the sense, you know, the thing behind it. But, yeah, there's no... It's I'm sure it's out there. It's like, but like you said, it's obviously not something that they were focusing on, in a sense. In other words, you know, everybody knew Fuller, like you said, from all the shows, and then the Alexander thing was a interesting debacle. But now who's there? I'm not quite sure either. So we can, I guess we can move on if you're not, if you didn't know offhand either. It's not, I guess it's not really that.
I saw the name on one of the things I had been reading, and I can't find it again. And when I do a Google search, all I keep coming up with is the soap opera drama of what went on behind the scenes. Right. You know, so it's not, it's, so yeah, I kind of gave up. I'm sure it'll pop up again.
Right, right, right. Yep. Yeah, I mean, even Wikipedia here, it says Fuller and Green served as the showrunners for the first season and are to be replaced by Jesse Alexander for the second season. So that they hasn't even been updated on Wikipedia. And as we know, the running joke, Wikipedia isn't always fact, but they're usually at least somewhat up to date. And sure enough, you know, 5 months since the Alexander debacle, or even longer, September of last year, we don't have any information even updated on Wiki. So, all right, so I guess we can move on. Yeah, so you want to start with the new episode. Yeah, so the main curiosity is the cliffhanger. I mean, that was a pretty interesting cliffhanger from last season where the blight comes and we thought it was going to be apocalyptic for maybe the entire world. And whether or not that's even in the book, I don't know, but let's assume that it doesn't matter. And what we have here is it actually now turns out to be only a regional thing. It could have meaning regional, even just one town. We really don't know because, like you said, they kind of just dropped that story plot, except for a news article on the radio. And maybe or maybe not, it will be important later in this season, but we don't know.
Right.
All right. So last season they were heading to this place, House on a Rock, and it actually does exist. I did research on it last year to see if it actually existed. Not last year, but 2 years ago when we did the cliffhanger of last episode, and I brought that up there that this place actually does exist. And I haven't really done further research, but it appears that it's almost like a Winchester house in a sense. So it looks pretty cool, though, don't you think, Mike?
Yeah, it was neat, and that's all apparently filmed there. right? So that's what it looks like. Yeah, Film OK, and some really neat stuff, but that's something, if I ever find myself in that neighborhood, I would have to stop by and take a look at, because, you know, I'm an American. I like touristy shit, so why not?
Yeah, same here. I've never actually been to the Midwest. So, yeah, so I was curious whether or not or why this place was chosen in Wisconsin. I don't remember. You just rewatched season one, but I don't remember it myself, but I haven't watched it for a while, recently as you. Was there a reason this House on the Rock was chosen, or was it arbitrary in the sense that it wasn't related to anything that was important? Like, for example, Devil's Rock in Close Encounters was a spot the aliens chose, and that's why people started heading there. Was this just chosen, someone chose it, or was it directly related to maybe that fortune teller card booth?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that they make a comment, I think, in this episode, although I ran through things. Everything's kind of running together. It's the idea, I guess, sort of like these sideshow attractions are sort of like American shrines, right, where people go to visit and, again, worship. They pay their attention to it in a way, you know, the same as we pay attention to our screens. So I think from that, it was probably just of all the various American attractions, it was probably one that was quirky enough and had enough variety to it that he was able to use it in the novel, and he certainly wasn't going to get, say, sued for it like he would have if he'd used Disney World.
That's a fair point.
So he probably wanted to use something real, you know, and it's got all this weird stuff, you know, and from what I know of Neil Gaiman, this sort of weird stuff is the sort of stuff that would just attract him to that. So I think it's more a quirk of the author than anything else.
Gotcha. Yep, and this place, based off of, it's almost like a Ripley's Believe It or Not, and a museum of quirky things that this guy just purchased and he brought to the museum and or the house and it turned it into just that. So that does make sense, because as we see when they walk around the building, it's not just a house, right? With couches and whatnot. There's amusement rides in it. There's a statue of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. I mean, it's just like crazy stuff in there. Crazy in a good way, not crazy as in bad. So yeah, so that makes sense that a place like this would fit into such a quirky story.
Yeah, I would think, and it's kind of, again, just visually. Provides a lot of interesting and neat things. So yeah, you do get like the fortune teller, you get the T-Rex. It's just a great image of this giant head hanging over everything. The carousel room and all these little things. It just seems to play into the eccentricity of the series pretty well. I don't know how well they use it, right? I mean, they're there and it's neat to look at.
Right, and most of the stuff is like in the background, you know. I mean, if it's not something that they focus on or very obvious, like the Tyrannosaurus head, it just goes right by. So you're right, they may not have used it as neat as they could, but again, they only have 50-something minutes, and they also wanted to focus on the alternate dimension, Odin's castle within his mind and all that too, right? So if they were going to focus on something as visuals, they went that route as well, rather than real things like this museum.
Right. So they had that meeting. This is where the first season ends. Was one of the last shots was all the cars, the various travelers arriving at the House of the Rock, even though we never saw the House on the Rock in the last episode. And we get there, and yeah, everyone kind of comes together. You've got our main, I guess, are they our main four characters? Obviously, Shadow Moon.
Yeah.
And Wednesday and
Shadow's Laura wife.
And Laura and Matt Sweeney, I guess, would be, you know, the four. Those are the four main characters.
Right. Yeah, and to be honest, I don't even know how main character Matt Sweeney is. I mean, he may be for the rest of the show, but, I mean, he was introduced late into season one and still was always a supportive character, but...
Well, he was there from the beginning in season one, right? He's the one that gives Shadow Moon the lucky coin that brings Laura back to life.
Yeah, all right, that's a fair point.
But
yeah.
he was in and out. He becomes a pivotal character because of, you know, we find out, I don't know if you remember this, we find out he's the one who murdered, they did mention in the episode, I think, that he's the one that murdered Laura.
Right.
At the behest of Wednesday Odin.
Yep.
And so that's why, even though he stages an accident in the last episode, and again, you know, or to get the lucky coin out of her chest, and he succeeds, and that's when we find out, you know, he feels guilty because he's the one that arranged her original accident, and he's not going to be a major part of the story, or doesn't have to be. But as long as the two are together like that, just as Shadow's tied to Odin, Laura's tied to Matt Sweeney, until that's broken, I think he's going to be a major player in the show.
Right, right. Yeah, and it appears that he wants to stay around Laura's character because she has the coin, right?
Right. And
eventually, he assumes he's going to get it back, which he probably will.
Well, he says he's hanging around because he knows if she's not going to give it back, because he's not allowed to take it involuntarily, you know, her body is rotting, and eventually it'll all the flesh will just fall off around it, and he can take the coin himself then.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. So as a result, yeah, I guess I can concur then that he's the fourth main lead. Right. And so they head to here to meet, I guess, a bunch of other quote unquote old gods, right? So Bilquis, who was a very curious character last season because her story focused mostly away from everybody else, and didn't have anything to do really with the other characters in the show. And now her story arc is now fully integrated with our lead characters. The two djinns are up here. The spider god is here now.
Chernabog.
Yeah, Chernabog. Peter Stormont's character is here now because he lost the game of chess or checkers or whatever it was, and he's here. And then some various other folks that are either unaligned or apt to join up with Wednesday's character if they're not so just yet.
Right, and we don't really get much. I'm assuming that was, I don't know my Hindu gods well. I'm assuming that was Shiva, because she said she's a god of battle or a god of war.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. She didn't say her name, did she?
She didn't say it. I'm assuming that was Shiva.
Right, right, right. Which makes sense for example, this story is a very controversial story in the sense that if you use modern religion, it can obviously cause some issues. I mean,
The way they portrayed Jesus in the last season was the idea, and that goes back to
multiple Jesuses because
episode 3 or 4. He said, he said something about his, you know, makes a comment about Jesus. Well, you got a Mexican Jesus, you got your evangelical Jesus, you got your Jesus of Nazareth, you got your this Jesus, you got your that Jesus. And Shadow Moon says, well, that's a lot of Jesus. He said, there's a lot of need for Jesus, so there's a lot of Jesus.
Right. Yeah, yeah. The character for this Hindu god is called Mama G. And it's presumed based off of Wikipedia that it's not actually Shiva, it's actually Kali.
Oh, okay. That makes sense, too.
It's smart to avoid real names of gods and goddesses. I mean, the Jesus one was pretty surprising for me, even though the point is really, really made well. But, yeah, obviously, you know, the mythos gods of Chernobog and whatnot makes more sense.
Uriah.
Yeah, it's much easier to use them without any issues.
Yeah, so they have them listed on IMDb as they have beautiful woman god, right? The more miscellaneous ones, because yeah. they tell them at the beginning there's like a dozen gods waiting for you, and so right. Beautiful woman god, unknown god, Ahura Mazda god, warrior woman god, Ame Nu Uzume god, MJ Hobo God, Thuggish Man God, Old Wizard God, and then, well, that's the museum guest. We don't worry about that one. Yeah, so that's, so they whether they are intended to be someone specific or just background characters, because I'm guessing many of them didn't survive the episode, although I don't think they were very clear on that.
Right, right.
That I can't tell. I don't know if they were relevant or not. I'm guessing that since Mama G, she had a speaking part and was pegged as that, I don't think we saw her get killed.
No, I don't believe she did, actually.
And was she the one that was the waitress in the American motel? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, she actually, I believe, survived, because I think she was one of the ones that were standing over Wednesday when he was cradling the goddess that was shot in the chest. I forget her name, the goddess that was shot in the chest.
Right, so we need Zariah, the fortune teller?
Yeah.
Sleacher?
Oh, yeah, it was her, right? That was her?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So yeah, it was her that didn't make it out of the episode, and Mama G was standing over and watching her pass away, I guess.
Yeah, I think part of the issue I have with that is that we never really meet most of the characters. You know, we're told they're already waiting.
Mm-hmm.
We never see them. You don't have like the bounty hunter scene in Empire Strikes Back where you see them all assembled in one spot, where you get a clear look at each and every one of them beforehand.
Sure, right.
And when you go to Valhalla, wherever it was they went, you know, in Odin's mind,
yep.
on the carousel, everybody looks different. They all have their god forms. You know, Odin with his one eye, with the big beard, Kali with her six arms, you know, the what's his name? The spider god.
Yeah, the spider god, yeah.
Is, you know, is got his eight eyes, and he's dressed in African apparel, tribal apparel. So it's hard to spot. And then when you come back to the real world, it's hard to see who to match up on a first viewing, who is whom.
Right, right. And also not just the fact that they appeared in their god format, but there was a lot of cool CGI that made them glow and their eyes glow and stuff. So to compare them in the real world with the ones in the mystical world, it was a bit difficult. I would agree with that.
Mr. Nancy, that was it. Was the spider god?
Gotcha.
A Nancy, yeah. So we don't know, and maybe it's not important. Maybe it does. All we need to know is that he had some allies, and everybody that we haven't met already is killed off.
Right. Right. Exactly. So yeah, like the survivors, basically the ones that were all introduced with speaking roles in season one are basically the survivors. And then all the rest that appeared are, like you said, they're just named hobo god or warrior woman god. In other words, they probably all get croaked in this episode.
Right.
And they were never developed in season one. And so when they appear here, they were just filler gods that were killed, basically.
Right. And we'll see if Kali, Mama G, ends up becoming somebody, you know, down the road.
Right,
if she
right.
has a significant role or not.
Right, right. Or will her role be similar to Zorna or Chernobog, which is their important characters, but they're, you know, here and there. Every three episodes you see them, and they're not necessarily a lead. They're more of a supporting role.
Right. Well, Chernobog was, you know, it's that some, there was some element of it, and it was not a lot of it, because really they only did it with Chernobog, if I remember. Well, no, they did it with Chernobog, and they did it with Vulcan, where, you know, it's that Magnificent Seven thing, where he's going around and rounding up the gang, they're recruiting.
Right. Well, so, and, yeah, so it was Chernobog, it was her, him, Vulcan, and then they kept on showing Bilquis, obviously, and then they also had the Jin and Salim, which weren't necessarily people he was recruiting, but they had important roles too, and all of them show up here. But
we do see him touch on the Jin, and you don't know it yet because you haven't met the Jin. It's in like episode 2.
Oh yeah, at the very beginning.
Where where they're like meeting in a diner, and all you see is him meet with this person. He bumps into Shadow Moon as he walks by. You see his glowing eyes, but you don't know who he is yet. So he's made a deal with him. So he's recruited the Jin. So we do see him. I take that back. So you do see him recruit the Jin. You do see him recruit.
Yeah, Chernobog and Zoria.
Zoria. We don't know. The other ones that we missed were Anubis and Ibis.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
From the first season, then they didn't show up here. We don't know if they refused his offer, or I don't know if they were late, or where that, or they're sitting neutral. What the deal is with that?
Right. What about Anansi or Mr. Nancy? What did he recruit him, or did he just? I forget. I can't remember.
He showed up. He was the one who made them their suits for the Easter party.
Yes, so technically, he was involved. That's a good point. Yeah, and then as we know, Vulcan, he got killed, right?
Right.
So he wasn't going to show up. And then he attempted to get,
Vulcan was corrupted.
Right.
And because he had already sold out to the new gods. And so Odin cut his head off. Yeah. He asked Vulcan to make him a sword. And for some unknown reason, he makes him the sword, gives it to Vulcan. Vulcan cuts his head off because he knows, not Vulcan, Odin cuts Vulcan's head off.
Right. Yeah.
That was the episode I was like the least enamored with in that season.
Yeah, that was a bad
episode. Because it felt like a complete digression.
Yeah. The pre-credit scene and then that whole episode, I agree. I wasn't a fan of it either. Also, the fertility goddess, too. He tried to recruit her, too, right? But she
she's already compromised.
Yeah.
And so she's sort of the, you know, the Trojan horse here. She's the... You know, she comes in, she brings the phone, which is introducing technology into this old place.
Yeah.
And so I don't, whether that allows them to directly hear what's going on or she just reports later, but she's there to basically sabotage it, right? And she gives a sales pitch. Hey, join the new gods. Look at what it's done for my complexion. You know, it's a wonderful. So that's what she's there to do.
Yeah. Who's the actress again that plays it?
I can never remember how to pronounce it. She was.
Oh, is that Yatidi Badaki?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Bilquis.
And wasn't she from True Blood? Am I correct?
But let me verify that just to make sure. And was it True Blood? She was in Lost in one episode. That's kind of bizarre. I swore I had read that she was in True Blood. Someone came from True Blood in the show, but I can't. It appears it wasn't her. How about that? No worries. Anyway, so she's and actually Odin didn't even want her to be there, right? She wasn't invited.
Right, but she says she plays. I'm the oldest of all the old gods, and therefore I have. Yeah, which makes she's a fertility goddess, right? And so that is certainly going to be one of the oldest of the old gods.
Right, and she said she existed before Odin was even...
had his first sacrifice to him, therefore she says she has to have her say before anybody else says anything.
Yeah. Right. And it appears that they don't know that she's a spy, right?
Well, I don't think they know it until after she comes out and says what she has to say.
Right. Right.
Right, because then by that point she's like, "Yeah, let me say what I have to say." She comes, she says what she has to say, and then it's, "Yeah, come to play, come and play for the new gods."
Right, right.
The new gods will give you a little piece of technology, right? They offered. Let's remember, they offered to turn Odin and to give him a missile system that would annihilate the North Koreans.
That's right.
And that's how he would get his followers back or become publicly relevant again.
Yeah.
So, and he turned them down.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good point. So yeah, all right. So it'll be curious to see where that story goes and Bilquis, and whether or not she is threatened by them. In other words, are these gods, we know that gods and goddesses are able to be killed, not just by being forgotten, but as we saw with Vulcan, can be killed by each other.
Right, but we don't know, because he says, was it in this episode? Right, he'd been killed before. Yeah, it was in this episode. He had been killed before. He'd been hung on Yggdrasil, the Tree of the World. And he got back. He came back 9 days later. So we don't know how permanent the god deaths are.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and he said he was more wise after coming back.
Yeah. So like a change. We see the new gods. We see we only see Technical Boy and Mr. World.
Right.
And in this case, Technical Boy, who used to be sitting in the back of the limousine,
yeah,
is now driving the limousine.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, again, I would have completely forgotten this if I hadn't watched the episode. At the end of season one, in a show of power, Odin strikes down. The Technical Boy had these minions.
Mm-hmm.
That were kind of reminiscent of the Droogs from Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
And and Odin strikes them dead with a lightning bolt. So I'm wondering, and they were the ones that would have been his chauffeurs. They were the ones that were his, that were Technical Boy's minions. And I'm wondering if these minions are permanently gone now, and that's why the Technical Boy is the one
driving the limo,
driving the car, as opposed to one of his minions.
Right.
So, you know, we don't know where Media went. We know where Media went. She quit. But they're getting a new Media.
Yep.
So there's a new actor, or I think actress, who's going to be playing the part instead of Gillian Anderson.
Well, and that's the thing, in the book, and I think we discussed this in our first season of the podcast, Media doesn't have a presence. In other words, she changes, like Marilyn Monroe, when she plays Marilyn Monroe and Lucille Ball in the TV show, it's still Gillian Anderson. Well, in the book, she actually takes the form. She's like a changeling or a doppelganger,
right,
that changes the form. So technically, her character could be the easiest to recast, because you don't need the actress if we follow based off of the book.
Right. It's unfortunate that they started something and they can't continue it.
Right.
You know, because she did David Bowie. She did. Yeah.
David Bowie. That's right. Yeah.
You know, it would be nice if they can continue it. But if they can't, she is the easiest character, I think, to replace on the show.
Right. Right.
For that reason. And I think if I read correctly, they're basically going to recast it as new Media, not as just Media.
Gotcha.
So I don't know if that means she's going to be like Angry Birds or something. I don't know.
Right. Well, actually, that makes sense if they want to modernize this and not make it a period piece from when the book came out. I mean, you're absolutely right. Apps and the internet and VOD and all that have replaced TV. So and CDs or records as David Bowie, and motion pictures as Marilyn Monroe. So it makes sense that they could go call the new character new Media, and it updates it actually. So I think that's okay.
All right. Okay. So they're in the thing. We are seeing, as this plays out, the new gods go to a place called Blackbriar.
Yeah, right, right. Which is in West Virginia. Right, well, that's the license plates of the cars.
The Blackbriar kind of works that way. I don't know why it was necessary. I don't know. I'm hoping if they've gone through the trouble of going there, that they're going to carry it forward from there. Because it wasn't like they called down a nuclear strike to take the gods out. They just called in Mr. Town to be the assassin
to
shoot the place up.
Yeah, basically a marksman.
Right.
A sniper.
And so I really do like Crispin Glover in this role. I do think we need somebody for him to play off of besides just the technical boy. We saw very little of him last season. He was in episode 5 in the prison. And we saw his face briefly in episode 12 and episode 8, and I think that was it. Yeah. But I'm hoping he has a bigger presence here, and I'm really curious to see what they do with more of the new gods, who they have as Mr. Town, who they have as new media. So the thing is that the war has begun, the war that there wasn't supposed to be a war. And it makes sense. He does. I missed it the first season, but basically he says in the first season to Odin, you know, that there's not going to be a war, in part because he's a war god. Right? So he can't be a war god if there's no war. So, yep. So it's sort of denying him some power by just refusing. It's playing into his hands by giving him a war. But anyway, so they call the sniper. The sniper shoots up the restaurant, kills Zariah. Shadow Moon runs outside to find the sniper and somehow gets abducted by aliens. Or something like that. I don't know exactly what that was.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good question. It was similar to an alien abduction, right? Where the beam comes down and it takes the cow or the person and it makes them disappear. But you're right. I mean, based off of this, it could be anything. It could be, I don't even know if I want to guess what it will be.
Yeah, well, I mean, your favorite, the Greys, those would kind of tie in with modern mythology, right?
Yeah, absolutely. As time has gone, and they even say it in The Exorcist, that one of the characters, Father Damien, says that when we were years ago, it used to be demon possession, and nowadays it's actually, it may not have been The Exorcist, but it was somewhere I read it, where back in the day, people used to think when people disappeared or went crazy, it was demon possession or demon abduction. Now, and as people became more and more worldly and not as religious, they switched over to Greys or aliens. And so you're right. This is definitely a modern thing, which is space aliens or alien abduction. And it's even more modern than back in the 20s when it was the little green men and flying saucers. So, yeah, that's true. So they could exist similar to the gods themselves, right? They're created by people in the belief. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, again, going back for a season, he says, you know, it's the chicken and the egg. You know, do they exist because you believe in them, or do you believe in them because they exist?
Exactly.
And I'm not sure even he knows the answer anymore.
Right.
You know, so do the aliens exist because, if those were aliens, because people believe in them, or do people believe in them because they exist?
Right. Exactly. Yep. No, it's true. That's an excellent point. And that's the thing. That's the thing that's I think I enjoy the most now after my odd experience with season one and now with this season here, is that I think that's the most interesting aspect of the show, is that do they exist because people believe they exist, or they are believed by people because they actually do exist? And I think that is a interesting concept.
Right, and it explains even the multiple Jesuses. You know, if you have people who believe in the Episcopalian Jesus, you know, the white Jesus. You have the blonde hair, blue eyed Jesus. You have people who believe in that Jesus is African. People who believe that Jesus was Mediterranean, you know, was Jewish, was all, you know, in terms of just physical appearance, you know. So, and everyone interprets, there's, you know, how many hundreds of different denominations of Christianity, you know, all have their own slightly different version of Jesus. And then how do you picture Jesus within your own ethnicity and,
well,
and all that other stuff?
I saw a couple, two movies actually that are going to be part of another podcast that I do, my Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Review podcast that was supposed to be a quarterly podcast, but it's now over 6 months. But I just saw two films, and it's interesting about that because they talk about that in the two films. I won't name them because people just can go listen to the episode when it does come out. But they talk about Jesus and God. Not just for physical appearance, but there's multiple Jesus or gods based off of how you believe they think. So if you believe that God, Jesus is someone that would look upon your sexuality as sinful, then you know, that form of Jesus where they're more apt to frown upon you or punish you, versus the Jesus that, you know, relishes in humanity, and so he's more positive and not as I guess punishing. And so I think that's what Neil Gaiman is grabbed based off of what we saw in season one. It's not necessarily just how he appears, but it's also how you think he would think as a person or a being.
Right. Now what's interesting is because they don't really talk about Jesus in this episode. They talk about him a lot in the last episode of the first season, especially in the conversations with Easter. They don't really deny Jesus as a historical figure, right? She says that Jesus died on my day, you know, yes. that it was a coincidence.
Yes.
So they're not trying to say that there was no Jesus, but you could, which I guess is one way to avoid pissing everybody off, but they're still going to do it. But basically, so whatever Jesus, you know, but the legend of Jesus has grown and changed and been distorted. And, you know, so you don't know what's true or not. And yeah, so this is not a series that I think people who take their religion, I don't want to say seriously, but are very sensitive about how it's portrayed, you know, that are unwilling to engage in what ifs and thought experiments. This is not going to be a show for you. But I think it's an interesting question to ask.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because I mean, not to pick on any specific Christian religion specifically, but I'll use historical examples. The Puritans, you know, believed, you know, that, you know, you have to wear your clothes when you have sex, or you can't eat certain types of foods during certain times of the year or whatnot and so forth. While a more different Christian religion at the same period were more apt to, you know, not care what you do behind closed doors as long as it, you know, it's not sinful. You know, so again, that's two different versions of the same thing, and therefore, if there's two different versions of the same thing, that's the reason why there's multiple different Christianity religions, whether it's Mormons, Jehovah's Witness, Catholics, Methodists, Presbyterians, or whatnot. And then depending on which one you are a member of, will determine also what type of belief you think Jesus and God look upon you as a human being.
Right. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm a very secular person. I was raised Catholic. But I'm a questioning person. It's why I was a science major in college. I don't fault people for having faith and belief. I can't go there without a lot of questioning, you know, and kicking the tires and wondering. And so I'm perfectly happy with these things. But I understand if some people don't like that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm similar to you. I'm a Roman Catholic as well, and I identify as a Roman Catholic. But mostly culturally rather than necessarily religious wise. So, you know, I may still have doubts and whatnot, similar to a, you know, a scientific person like yourself. But I also can most certainly see how some of our listeners, for example, one listener, Kevin Letts, would be somewhat shocked at this, you know, so this show. So it's yeah, you know, I mean.
I don't know if he's, I mean, I'm sure there's no ideas here that would be completely new to him.
Right, right, yeah.
But he takes his faith very seriously, and he takes his Bible seriously. I don't know how literally he takes it.
Right.
But I know he takes it seriously. And so some people like that just, they don't like questioning the veracity of what their beliefs are, you know, because they believe it's right. Blasphemous. And he's not the only one. It's not just Christian faith where there are people like that. You know, I'll be curious to see if, as the series goes on, if they address other modern religions besides Christianity.
Right, right. Well, Hindu too, right? Because, I mean, if
yeah.
Mama G is Kali, I mean, whether she's Kali or not, it's implied she is.
She is a Hindu, yes.
She is still a Hindu, yeah, exactly.
You know, would they have the balls to throw Muhammad in there? Will they throw Buddha in there? Will they, you know...
Right. Well, I think the last time Muhammad was able to be used in... I guess art like this was probably Dante's Inferno, and I don't think it would work going forward.
Ironically, they used him in an episode of South Park.
Oh,
and nobody gave a shit, and then 9/11 happened, and then everybody gave a shit, and the next time they tried to use him in an episode, they got censored.
Gotcha.
But it wasn't a big deal. But then after that, you started getting like the Charlie Hebdo or whoever it was that. The Hobby cartoons.
Yes.
And the funny thing is they had South Park had already used him and nobody cared because nobody was paying attention. But yeah, whatever.
Right.
So, although it also wouldn't be, well, it would be somebody portraying Muhammad, right? It's not a graven image.
Yeah. Well, like for example, in the 70s, there was a film that Anthony Quinn starred in and he played that role, but they never showed him on screen. It was like it was interesting how it was. I've never seen the film, like, but yeah. So I guess it's always been there as a question. So I see your point though, which it's more. I have no idea what I'm saying, but
yeah, I don't know.
So, I don't know what I'm saying, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, so I don't know if it goes back. Like, they didn't like depictions, period. So it was when chess got introduced in the Muslim world is kind of where we got something close to the modern chess pieces.
Yep.
Because before that, they were people.
Yep.
And then they moved to these more abstract figures. So you weren't playing with the image of a king and the image of a queen and the image of the knight or right. what have you.
Right, right.
The archer, I think, was the bishop in India. So anyway, we're way, way, way far afield now. So anyway, what did you overall think of the episode?
Well, I'll say this. I felt whenever they went to the new gods, I wasn't as interested. I know it was well acted and whatnot, but it really didn't do anything for me that much. My more interest was to be with the characters that we've been following throughout the first season mostly. And besides, I felt that when they did the showy stuff, meaning, you know, see the carousel, see Odin's world and whatnot, before they actually get into dialogue, I felt those were just somewhat a filler. I mean, it was nice to look at and whatnot, but the R of it didn't really, you know, make a big imprint on me. But as long as they talked between the characters, I actually enjoyed it a lot. I purposely waited until late last evening to watch the show. I mean, because I guess it had been released earlier. I honestly didn't know that it had been released earlier. Going forward, it's going to be released Sunday in the evening. But for this first episode, it appeared it got released earlier for some reason. And so really that didn't matter in the sense whether I wanted to wait or not. It didn't really matter because I didn't know. And so when I watched it, I wasn't really happy to watch it, especially after the first 5 minutes. Because again, they weren't focusing on the characters that I wanted to focus on. But by the end of the episode, I was actually enjoying myself a lot. And I'm looking forward to seeing the next episode.
I wasn't fond of I like Mr. World. Wasn't fond of him going into a military bunker. That just didn't feel quite right to me. I don't know what the story for, especially not for where it went. Mm-hmm. Right. I can understand him doing that, but I just didn't understand him doing that for that result. I was more interested in what was going on. I kind of liked where they did the fortunes. I thought that was kind of interesting. Obviously, the reason why Laura's fortune was blank is because she is dead and she doesn't have a future as long as she's dead. I'll be curious to see what Shadow's fortune, that his favorite color is, or his lucky color is dead, and his lucky number is none.
Right.
Lucky color or favorite color being dead, I'm imagining could be referring to Laura.
Yep.
But why his lucky number is none? Does that mean he's just bad luck?
Right. You know. I mean, they do throw out one line out that it's just a fake fortune from a quarter run, you know, machine. But I think that's really just a red herring because, like you said, why even have the scene have that much prominence if it didn't really mean something to his fortune and his color, you know, being so obscure like that.
Right. And they do mention the last line is like father, like son. And while they talked a little bit about his mother in the first season, we don't know anything about his father yet. So I'll be curious to see if that means we're going to learn something about his father this season.
Right. Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, one of his parents was, I believe, an African American, and one of his parents was Norwegian, and I forget which was which.
Because he has this conversation when he first meets Wednesday, and he says, "What's your name, Shadow Moon?" And he says, "Oh, mom. Let me guess. Mom was a hippie." And he describes her as having, you know, as having like the big afro.
Right, right. And you know what? It makes sense too, because the rumor from season one was the Norwegian father was Wednesday, because he's Norwegian, right? He's Scandinavian. He's the god of the Teutonics.
Right.
So if that's going to be the case in the play in a future episode, Luke, I am your father. You know, Shadow, I am your father. Then it makes sense that his father would have been the Norwegian.
Right, and they're both con men. They're both, you know, hustlers. They both like coin tricks. So, yeah, it could play.
Yep.
There are changes. I don't think the visuals worked as well. Now, that could be because of the change in showrunner, the change in budget. It could be because they were relying just on the visuals that were already natural with the House on the Rock, and they didn't have to quite get as fancy. It could be me just being overly questioning, knowing that there was a showrunner change. The dialogue was more direct, but I think you're at the point now, again, where everything is out. Everything is out front for us to see. So they don't have to be
coy.
A lot of people, there was a lot of talking in riddles in the first season.
Right.
There were a lot of asking questions in the first season. Well, now it's time for answers, and that should be changing the dialogue, right? It should be changing the style. I think there was a more obvious forward momentum in this. I saw some reviews that said nothing really happened. You know, but more happened in this episode than happened in most of the episodes last season.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
At least in my opinion, you know, you had, you know, an entire episode was meeting Chernobog, having dinner with him, having him tell you his backstory, and then playing checkers with Shadow Moon.
Right.
You know, that was an entire episode.
It was.
you know, an entire episode of drive halfway, you know, we're in the Midwest, drive all the way back to the East Coast to do the stuff with Vulcan, and then drive all the way back, you know, for basically ending up exactly where you were at the start of the episode. So there were all sorts of, like, dead ends and or what felt like sometimes stalling for time. And I don't know how much of that came out of the book and how much didn't. So here felt like, oh, we've been talking about The Rock, where they were talking about meeting in Wisconsin all last season. They finally did. And we finally, and there wasn't like three episodes of meetings. We got a consequence from that. You know, you had the New Gods, even if I didn't particularly care for that part of the story arc, you had the New Gods take a step, you know, and do some actual retaliation, where last season it was more, no, we don't want to attack him. And they had the technical boy saying, he's right here, just kill him. You know, just kill him. You know, just, what are you doing? And they're like, no, he deserves respect, because he's an old god, you know, so they wouldn't do it. So they were fearful, either they were fearful of him or respectful of him, we'll see. But there was reluctance to actually do something.
And that changed here.
And that seems to have changed here. And we'll see if this continues. And, you know, maybe this is viewing it closer to the book. I don't know how long the show is going to run. You know, I'm kind of get the feeling it might be like a 3-season series.
Right. If we discuss, right, there technically are sequel books, if not directly related to the first, they're semi-sequels, I guess, so they could go that route. But if they don't, you said season 3, they could go 3 seasons?
That would be my guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would look at it, you know, like Lord of the Rings. You make Lord of the Rings, yes, you can do, you know, the Silmarillion, and yes, you can do The Hobbit. Yeah. But that's not Lord of the Rings. It's set in the same universe as Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And you can do more stories with American Gods if American Gods is successful.
Yep.
But it's still not going to be that book anymore. It's going to be a spinoff from that book.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah. So if they stuck to the book, because... you know, based off of, you know, this is the Rock, the House on the Rock, and supposedly it's in the book, then I think even if 10 to 15 minutes was show and tell and curiosity, things like the fortune and whatnot, it still took a step forward to wherever they're going, compared to, like you said, some of the other episodes in the season one, like the whole Vulcan thing. First of all, was made up by Fuller and Green anyway. It wasn't even in the book, so they weren't going to go much. It was like a dead end. There was no reason for the episode. So here, at least, it appears that this is moving forward, even if 10 to 15 minutes of it may have felt draggy to some critics.
Right, and you know, now I'm thinking about it, and I don't know why I didn't pick up on this. I should have. For me, the most of the best parts of the first season were when they did these little vignettes, the coming to America or somewhere in America.
Yeah, the pre-credit scenes that it appears they're doing away with in this season, or at least in the
first because episode. It was all introductory. It was like introducing the gods. It was introducing the concepts. So they used Mrs. Fadil to introduce Anubis, the god of death, and they used the Vikings to introduce the concept of the gods coming to America and Odin, and they used Nancy in the slave ship.
Right, and then they used the mammoth one to show that the gods are created by people, not by already existing.
And that they would die when you forgot about them.
Right, yeah. Right.
And they spent an almost entire, or a good portion of the second to last episode telling the backstory of Matt Sweeney and this and the Irish girl.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. So there was a lot of stuff that was backstory that were tangential to the main storyline. And with that removed, it helps, I think, the main story in a way. But it also is taking away some of the best parts of the first season.
Right, right. Yeah. The vignettes in the first season were probably the best part of the first season because they were short, quick, compact, and very interesting.
Right. That's the story of Sadil and the Djinn.
Yes.
That's another one of those.
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah. And those were really some of the best parts. Because I was looking, I was thinking, like, what were the, some of the best moments, the best scenes in the first season. And almost all of them, or I put a top 10, like five of the top 10 were those scenes, yeah. And they just stuck out. And they were because what was most of the rest of the season? There were conversations between Shadow Moon and Wednesday, and they were all great, but one wasn't necessarily any more standout or better than the other. Yep. You had small snippets like Laura kicking the technical boy's minion in the crotch and splitting him in half.
Right, right. The police scene was okay. It was pretty good.
The police station scene,
When she comes out of the morgue, that was pretty good.
When she comes out of the morgue and she goes to her friend's house and she's sitting on the toilet with one arm.
Yeah, that's right.
She's getting rid of the embalming fluid. And she's like, get out of here. Was it something like, get out, you zombie whore, or something like that?
Yes, that was awesome. Yeah.
So there's all that. So there was stuff, but there wasn't. But most of the stuff that stood out, possibly because it was different and they were totally different and had different characters, were all those introductions to the gods.
Right. And they were more straightforward, too, in a sense, too, right? I mean,
we knew what they were about, right?
It wasn't riddles.
There's a woman who dies and she goes to the afterlife, and this is the afterlife there. It's a nice little short story.
Yep. Yeah, nice vignette.
And it actually reminds me, Neil Gaiman had written the Sandman comics for DC, where Sandman being the entity of sleep.
Okay.
Right, not a superhero.
Yep.
And that had its own big overarching storylines, but one of the most popular issues of that entire run was one issue that told the story of his sister Death, and it was just a little standalone side story about Death. It was completely self-contained. It wasn't a long sprawling story arc or any of this other stuff, and it remains a classic issue of a classic comic. So that kind of also feels like a Neil Gaiman thing.
Yep. Yeah, so that's a good point. And that's the thing here is that even though this episode didn't have it, at least I felt there was enough within this episode besides the New God stuff that were interesting. And even though I felt some of those showy scenes were unnecessary, it didn't really hinder the flow too much, I felt.
I think we'll see where it's going in the future, right? Because, again, these were episodes that had to get rewritten and rewritten.
Yeah.
And in some cases, rewritten again.
Yep.
They're trying to force it on track. They have to address the changes, which they've kind of done now. And, we'll see where they are in the next episode or two. How does the story move forward? Does it hew more closely to the book? And I look forward to judging it on those grounds. I don't think this is the best episode of the series, but it is not as disappointing as I was expecting it to be. I think it's different in some ways tonally, but I don't think those differences are necessarily bad. They're just...
I think they're better because it's like you said, it's not dragging out hidden agendas. I mean, obviously we have the fortunes and what do they mean, but those are setups for, something coming up or just clues for us. But the episode was pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And that certainly could have more appeal to some people. And certainly I think they were too much. I think it was too much last season of, unless you were willing to go on Wikipedia, unless you'd read the book or unless you were willing to go on Wikipedia or on the internet somewhere and have someone tell you what the show was about. It took too long for the show to tell you what the show was about.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. If you don't, and especially, people who are unfamiliar with mythology, right? I mean, you may not know that Wednesday is actually the name of Wotan, which is the German name for Odin, which, and And some people may not even know who Odin is. You know, I remember just a year and a half ago, I was talking to a Dungeons and Dragons geek, and he thought Thor was the head of the Norse gods. And I said, no, it's Odin. And he goes, no, it's Thor. I'm telling you. And then, of course, a week later, he goes, yeah, you're right. It was Odin. You know, because he didn't even know Odin existed, except for maybe, you know, the comic book and in passing, you know.
Right, but even the comic book, Odin is the Allfather. You know, they make a big deal out of that. They cast Hannibal Lecter as Odin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and when I was a kid and I read the Norse mythology, Odin was like one. I always liked him more so than Thor because he was the focal point. So, I was familiar with him. But if I had never read any Norse mythology, I would have been like, who's Wednesday? What's this Wednesday stuff? So, you're deciphering who they are in the season one, but if you don't know who they are, even after you decipher who they are, you still could be confused. You know, right. So once they, you know, and especially like the Vikings coming over, and that's how Odin comes over, or Votan, if you prefer. And it's a little vignette that happens at one point in the series, and so if you forget it or didn't understand it, you still could be a bit confused, I think.
Yeah, and this is something we've talked about in the Dark Discussions podcast several times.
Many times, which is
how obtuse can a story be on the first time watch? It's great when you have stories that make a lot of sense on your second watch, or you pick up things up the second and third time, but you can't be so, you know, obscure in your writing that you lose the audience, so they never want to watch it again.
Right, right. Well, even like, and I know you liked the film Hereditary. I mean, it was one of the better films of last year. Some of the backlash has been it was being too clever, and, you know, things were there that you wouldn't catch until you watch it for the second, third, fourth, fifth time. And as a result, it got some backlash. Not necessarily that's okay. I mean, that was right that it got the backlash, but that was, you know, if you're going to be clever, sometimes that happens. And for a show like this, and in some ways it didn't do it as well as Hereditary, the movie, it may cause some backlash that actually is probably deserved.
Right, and some people missed it. I think Hereditary did a good job of explaining itself by the end, but I could also understand where some people don't see it that way. You know, it all depends on whether you got the explanations or didn't get the explanations, you know, it's, and the same thing here, either you figured it out by the end or you didn't, but did you want to wait 8 episodes to figure out what was going on?
Sure, sure. Right, right. And I know some movies like they have like extras, or there's a tie-in comic book or something. And if you're not going to read those things or watch those things, then maybe it should have been included in the story at the first place, because if the only way to understand it is to read those things or watch those things, then it may be an issue if people who don't read those things or watch those things still are confused.
Right. I think, you know, the Marvel movies, you know, like them or not, I think they've done a decent job of connecting the different films together without requiring you to really see everything else. But of course, they're basic comic book movies. They're not, you know, they're not Shakespeare. They're not Stanley Kubrick. You know, the storylines are pretty simple, so it's not too hard to jump on board.
Right, right. Yep, absolutely. What was it? This show here, if you start season 2, episode 1, without reading the book or watching season 1, you may be a little confused, I think. But again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because this is not an episodic show. It's a show that has a starting point and an ending point. But definitely, if you start with season 2, episode 1, you may be a bit confused.
Right.
All
right. So I think that does a good job of wrapping up the talk about season 2, episode 1, The House on the Rock.
Yeah, just a couple of information about The House on the Rock. It was written by Jesse Alexander, believe it or not, and Neil Gaiman. So it's their teleplay or screenplay. Someone named Christopher J. Byrne was the director. I'm not sure who he is. I didn't bother looking him up on IMDb, and it doesn't appear that he has a wiki page yet, so he must be fairly new. Though he does state here, because they have released all the screenwriters and directors for season two, Christopher J. Byrne does direct the season finale as well. So that's the information there. U.S. viewers to be determined. It hasn't been released yet. The show just came out technically yesterday, even though I think it was may have even been released a day earlier. But it was definitely released on Sunday morning because I saw it there and I started watching it before I put it away. Next episode is The Beguiling Man, and that's next week's episode. That one will actually not be released early. It is specifically going to be released Sunday night. So that's pretty much all I got there. But yeah, all in all, this episode I was fairly happy with. I could see how some critics felt it may have dragged a bit because the whole show takes pretty much place in one location. A lot of talking. A lot of showy scenes. And besides the couple of scenes with the new guards, the only scene that takes place outside of the house is in Odin's mind, which is, you know, Valhalla, the castle, or whatever it was. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was solid TV. Your thoughts, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. They had a lot to do in this episode. I think they kind of did it. They had to move on from where they were last season, which they did, you know. And most of the other episodes they've done have been very personal. And here they had a lot of characters to deal with at once, sort of big events to deal with at once. And so they might be able to get back to a little bit of a different pace and a little bit of maybe that will let them be more indulgent for better or for worse. We'll see. But yeah, I liked the episode. I didn't love it. I definitely want to stick with it. And I'm hoping that a lot of the behind the scenes stuff ironed itself out by the season goes along and it gets a little smoother, you know, as it reestablishes its own new style with the new showrunner, but we'll see.
Yep. Technically we will be here for another 1, 2, 3, 4, possibly 8 episodes if we do a wrap up episode, but we may just combine that with the final episode 8 of season 2 anyway. But yeah, so technically we'll be here for another 7 episodes at the least, unless something comes up. I know me and Mike have an overlap for I think 3 weeks where this show will be on at the same time as Game of Thrones, the last episode 6, 7, and 8. And as a result, me and Mike also do another podcast, Dark Discussions podcast, besides this one. And then during Game of Thrones, we have You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, the Game of Thrones podcast. So there may be a 1 or 2 day delay for episode 6, 7, and 8 of the podcast because of that. I know we're one of the only few podcasts about the show that's out there. We don't want to hold up the release of the episode too long. Note that our episodes for the last 3 episodes of this season of American Gods may be 1 or 2 days later than usual. We're trying to get these out on Monday or Tuesday, but the last 3 may land up on Wednesday and Thursday, depending on time. Also, you can reach us at darkdiscussions@aol.com. We did have a lot of email feedback last year from a number of folks, including Elizabeth, Catherine Gray, Kevin Letts, and a handful of others. It's darkdiscussions@aol.com and darkdiscussion1, how you can reach us. That's the Twitter, darkdiscussion1. And we will most certainly read your email on the episode if it is helpful to the discussion of the show. That's the main thing, the discussion of the show, your opinion of American Gods, the book, how it relates to each other, how we discuss the topics and what you think of our opinions, or you prefer to add to our opinions, please email us. We are excited to get your emails. Anything else that you wanted to mention, Mike?
No, I think that's it for this week. Again, as Phil said, send us your letters, send us your messages. The more, especially if you're a big fan of the show or the novel, to give us some insights, because there's a lot here to see from different points of view. Phil has his, I have mine, but our backgrounds really are not all that different. So we can see it one way, where other people will see things very differently or pick up things in a different way, depending on what your cultural background is.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you once again for joining us on Searching for American Gods and our journey through Season 2. For those who are new, hopefully you are all up to date with Season 1 of the show and maybe have gone back and listened to all 8 or 9 or 10 episodes of our podcast that we recorded 2 years ago on Season 1. What you hear tonight is pretty similar to how we do Dark Discussions and all our other spin-off podcasts as well. Hopefully you enjoy our discussions and don't get annoyed.
We are on Game of Thrones. We're joined by Eric Webster of the Ascansity podcast. And on Dark Discussions, we're joined by Eric Webster, along with writer Chrissy Peterson Schoonover and perspective writer Abe Spiney. So there's 5 of us on that one.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And we also do a podcast on Westworld called Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast, which includes myself and Mike as well as Eric Webster. On the Dark Discussions feed, again, there's the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Review episodes where I review boutique labeled discs that are genre or art house. The last one actually came out in August of 2018, but I have one in the scope to be completed by the beginning of April. And then we do have one other podcast called Anthony T's Horror Show, where he talks, Anthony Thurber talks about horror conventions, new films, interviews some of the artists, and gives his opinion also on DVDs and things of that nature. And that's pretty much who we are and what we do. We all have day jobs. So this is really just a hobby, but based off of the fact that me and Mike have been doing this, at least Dark Discussions podcast, since 2011, it shows you our commitment to podcasting, even if we are not getting anything really out of it except for good discussions and meeting you folks who listen to our podcast, whether remotely or at conventions. So I guess with that, Mike, along with anything else that you want to say, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Well, again, thank you for listening to Searching for American Gods. We hope to see you again, that you'll hear from us again next week. We hope to get some emails, some letters. Please join us on the Dark Discussions podcast page on Facebook. And until next week.